Thank you for being here this morning. Thank you for an interest in a study like this. Thank you especially for your interest in the study of this subject. Are we all right, David? I do think it's so important. My assignment is to talk about Jesus and wine, to talk about the things that Jesus personally did, the things that he taught relative to the subject of wine. Let's approach it this way. Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21, that Jesus left us a perfect example and that we should follow in his steps. And that being the case, therefore, what Jesus taught and what he personally practiced in regards to the subject of intoxicating wine or wine in general, that's a pattern. That's a pattern for us to honor, a pattern for us to respect, a pattern for us to imitate. And so if Jesus approved of the use of intoxicating alcoholic wine, if he, in fact, perhaps even promoted it, then we cannot reasonably oppose it. In fact, we ought to embrace it. We ought to do it as he did. I've been troubled somewhat. I'm not going to go too far into this because Doy's going to talk about the wisdom related to this subject later. But I think it's an untenable position to say Jesus participated in the use of intoxicating wine. I don't. I think it's wiser for me not to, but I believe that Jesus did. Well, no, that's not right. If Jesus did it, it's wise. And it would be wise for us to do it as well. We ought to. So I've run into a number of people who said, I don't personally participate. I don't think it's wise for me to do so, but I believe that Jesus did. Well, that's a self-contradictory position. If Jesus did, then it's wise. And it would be wise for us to do as he did. On the other hand, though, if Jesus did not endorse or support the use of intoxicating wine, then we are right to oppose it, and I believe right to strongly oppose it. And I hope that all of us will be doing that. There's a real softness on this subject, and we need to take a strong stand. And I think that's obviously the direction this conference is heading, and I'm glad for it. Let's talk about Jesus and wine. First of all, let's ask the question, did Jesus approve of the use of alcohol by his own practice, by his own personal example? Let's start out by talking about what I think is the most popular argument that we're likely to hear relative to this part of the discussion, and that is the wedding feast at Cana of Galilee in John chapter 2. I'm not going to take time to read that text. We're going to reference it here, but you know the passage, and you understand the arguments that are made there. I do think that it is probably what most often comes up. I'm not going to spend any time at all. Kyle did such a superior job of describing to us that wine in the Bible can mean all sorts of product of the grapevine. It can mean intoxicating drink, but it can mean the equivalent of what we would call grape juice and lots of things in between there, I suppose. But I'm going to base our discussion here on the understanding that we already have about that. And so really the question is, was it intoxicating wine or was it simply something on the order of grape juice? Here's how this text is being used. An author by the name of Wiltenberg said, at the very least, the story of Cana's wedding feast indirectly supports or indirectly approves the use of alcoholic beverages. That's how he sees it. Another fellow by the name of Herschel Hobbs, he's deceased now, but he was once the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. In fact, I understand he had the nickname Mr. Southern Baptist at one time. He said, there is no point debating whether or not this was real wine. The Greek word oinos normally denotes the fermented juice of the grape. The ruler's appraisal of it in verse 10 suggests that it was wine of the best quality. And so here's a fellow, Southern Baptist, a prominent Southern Baptist in his day. He believed that it was alcoholic wine. Burton Kaufman, I know you know his name in the commentaries that he's written. He said the opinion of the ruler of the feast that the wine Jesus made was superior in quality to that they had drunk earlier supports the conclusion that it was not merely pure grape juice. To read wine as grape juice seems to this writer to be a perversion of the Word of God. Kaufman said, if you say that that's just grape juice, you're perverting the Word of God. It's pretty strong. I think you'd agree. I think it's also fairly uninformed. It surprises me somewhat that he would say that. So one side of the argument is, oh yeah, there's just no doubt. I had a member of the church recently tell me Jesus definitely made intoxicating wine at the wedding feast of Cana in Galilee, and he participated, he partook of it himself. No question about it. He was absolutely certain of that. There are other people, plenty of other people, who see it the other way. For instance, a man named Torrey, who was once superintendent of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, said there is not a hint that the wine he made was intoxicating. There is not a hint that our Lord produced alcohol. Another fellow named Pettingill, who was dean at the Philadelphia College of the Bible, he was a contemporary, he was an associate of Cyrus Scofield, of Scofield Bible fame. He said, I'm satisfied that there was little resemblance in it to the thing described in the Scripture of God as biting like a serpent and stinging like an adder. So he says, I don't see how that could possibly have been intoxicating wine. So how do we decide? I just point those quotes out to say people are on all sides of this question. How would we decide? Can we decide? Can we be definitive about what Jesus produced at the wedding feast at Cana of Galilee? If we're going to decide, we're going to have to decide based upon the context, the occasion, all the circumstances that are associated with it. One of the arguments that's made comes from the statement there in John chapter 2, verse 10, that when the ruler or governor or master of the feast was given to drink what Jesus had produced, he said, every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine, then, and he says, when men have well drunk, then that which is worse, but thou hast kept the good wine until now. The phrase there, well drunk. The claim is, of course, that that proves that the wine that they were drinking there was intoxicating wine. They were well drunk when they received that Jesus had made. The fact of the matter is, though, just from, I think from sort of just a logical point of view, if the ruler of the feast and others who were there were, in fact, already intoxicated to some degree, then it would have been difficult for them to discern that the wine Jesus was being had produced and was being served to them. They would be hard for them to discern that it was better. So I just think from a logical point of view, that doesn't really fit. If they're drunk to some degree already, well drunk, then how would they be able to even detect something better was being served to them? The word drunk comes from a Greek word that can mean intoxicated sometimes. In fact, frequently it does, as it's used in both the Bible and secular literature of the day. But it can also simply mean satiated or full. McGuigan notes that it is used that way in the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. He cites Isaiah 55:10, Hosea 14, verse 8. Your outline may be wrong there. That, I think maybe your outline says Haggai. That's supposed to be Hosea 14, verse 8. Bacciocci, Kyle mentioned his book last evening, and I would encourage you. He's a Seventh-day Adventist, so he's wrong on a lot of things, but he's very thorough on Bible wines. And if you don't have his book on that, I encourage you to get it. Very thorough. He says the verb methusko in John 2:10 is used in the sense of satiation. It refers simply to the large quantity of wine generally consumed at a feast without any reference to the intoxicating effects. And so I think the well-drunk argument fails, first of all, because the word does not necessarily mean intoxicated, but secondly, also just from that logical point of view, how would they even be able to discern anything different if they were already intoxicated? Then from this text also is argued the expression good wine, that it proves it was intoxicating because it was good wine. The ruler of the feast called what Jesus had miraculously produced the good wine. Now, what is argued there is that it therefore had a higher alcoholic content, thus was more intoxicating than what they had already been drinking. Now, think about that. That goes against the grain. I think there's already been some reference to this in our discussion. There's indication that the people of the day regarded the good or best wine as that which was not intoxicating. Plutarch and Horace each mentioned that the best wine was that which was harmless or innocent. Pliny indicated that the good wine was that which was destitute of spirit. And again, logically, how would the ruler of the feast be able to detect immediately upon tasting the wine? How would he be able to detect this is better? You could get drunk quicker on this than what we've been drinking. I don't know. I'm not a drinker, obviously, but I don't know how you would be able to detect intoxicating capacity at first drink. Maybe after some minutes of having drunk it, you could say, "Boy, I'm really getting drunk on this stuff." I don't think you could detect that upon first taste. Well, he was referring to its flavor, right? That's why it was good wine. It was wine because it was of superior taste. I really think that the good wine argument doesn't really make much sense either. So the well-drunk or the good wine argument that some people would try to use from this text, I think it fails to prove that Jesus produced intoxicating wine. But I actually think maybe the best argumentation comes from the quantity that was produced and the moral implications of that. Jesus made a lot of wine, and if it was intoxicating wine, what does that say about him and his involvement in that wedding feast? The 6 water pots that were used, Jesus instructed them to be filled with water, you remember. And John 2, verse 6 and 7 tells us they contained 2 or 3 firkins apiece. A firkin is 8.66 some odd gallons. Consequently, the amount of liquid in the stone jars would exceed 110 gallons. There are other estimates. I've read estimates as high as 120 to 160. I think Kyle mentioned perhaps maybe even as high as 180 gallons of wine. There are, we should know, probably some estimates that are lower, maybe even as low as 60 gallons. But even at 60 gallons, we're talking about a considerable quantity of wine that's being produced. Now, regardless of what conversion factor you want to use, what you have to acknowledge is that if the guests were already intoxicated and Jesus made huge quantity of wine that was also intoxicating, maybe more intoxicating than what they had been drinking, then I think he was at least contributing to their drunkenness. Kevin and I talked a few weeks ago over the phone. One of the factors in this wedding feast story that we don't know is we don't know how many guests were there. Were there 2 or 3 dozen? Were there 2 or 300? We don't know, obviously. But look at it this way. Experts tell us that impairment can come with as little as 10 fluid ounces of wine. You can begin to demonstrate that your judgment is impaired, your reaction time's impaired with just 10 fluid ounces of wine. For some people of low body weight, maybe people who hadn't eaten much food, so forth, drunkenness can be measured. Legal drunkenness can be measured with as little as 15 fluid ounces of wine. Okay, now, let's take a conservative number. Let's say that Jesus produced 100 gallons of wine. That'd be someplace sort of in the middle of the estimates that are out there, maybe conservatively low. But if he made as much as 100 gallons of wine, that'd be enough to impair 1,280 people who drank it. That would be enough to get 850 people legally drunk. Now, when you think about that, compare that to the statement of Habakkuk 2, verse 15. You're familiar with that verse. Woe to him that giveth his neighbor drink, that putteth his bottle to him, that maketh him drunken also, that thou mayest look on his nakedness. The prophet there is using that statement metaphorically against the Babylonians. I'd be interested in our discussion period to get your input as to whether it's fair for us to use that verse that way. I tend to think that it is, but maybe some don't. We'll talk about that later. Even in John 2, though, it says in verse 11 that the purpose of the miracle that Jesus performed there was to manifest his glory. But if these people were drunk and he made them more drunk, that wasn't a glory thing. That was a shame thing. He'd be manifesting shame if he did that. So I think the very purpose of the miracle would be contradicted if he was helping people become more drunken. And then, of course, what Jesus himself said in John 17, beginning verse 1, it is impossible, but that offenses will come. But woe to him through whom they come. It were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and that he cast into the sea than that he should offend one of these little ones. I think that has obvious, direct application to the question of what did Jesus do? He would have been putting a stumbling block before these people, right? To cause them to be drunken. Maybe they were already drunk. He's causing them to be more drunken. I just don't see how that view harmonizes with the character of Jesus, with his own teaching. And so for all those reasons, I just think we have to argue that Jesus did not... Is that going to go away on its own? Yeah. Jesus did not produce alcoholic, intoxicating wine at the wedding feast of Cana. In my opinion, now I'll get your input here in a few minutes, but in my opinion, it's beyond question. I just don't think that's questionable. A lot of people do. A lot of people, I think, who have not really seriously thought about all the implications of that, still maintain that Jesus made alcoholic wine. I just don't think that he did. One conservative fellow told me recently, I thought it was kind of interesting the way he put it. He said, if Jesus made intoxicating wine at the wedding feast of Cana of Galilee, then what it proves is not only can you participate in it, you can make it. And not only can you make it, you can be a distributor of it. Not only could you be a distributor of it, you could own and operate a package store if Jesus made wine at the wedding feast of Cana of Galilee. Now, most people would not be willing to go to that extreme conclusion, but I think it follows. People really need to think about making that argument in regards to what Jesus did. There's another argument made from the life of Jesus, and that's the expression that Jesus came eating and drinking, that he was a wine bibber. The text is in Matthew chapter 11, beginning in verse 18. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he hath a devil. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, behold, a man gluttonous and a wine bibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. But wisdom is justified of her children. That same parallel text is in Luke chapter 7. What do people think about that? Kenneth Gentry, who's a Presbyterian author, said Jesus himself drank wine. As a matter of fact, in Luke 7, beginning verse 33, he makes reference to his practice of drinking wine as a vivid illustration of the distinctive difference between himself and his forerunner, John the Baptist. A fellow by the name of Horace Bumstead, I wondered after I read his quote whether he's any kin to Dagwood Bumstead. I don't know. But he was a past president of Atlanta University. He said the Bible sanctions the use of wine by the example of Christ. This sanction is undeniable and emphatic. Undeniable because we have the statement of fact in in Christ's own words. Emphatic because his example as a user of wine is expressly contrasted by himself with the example of his forerunner, John the Baptist, who was an abstainer from wine. A college professor named Irving Raymond said, Jesus Christ undoubtedly followed the usual customs of his day and drank wine at daily meals and at different kinds of celebrations. There is direct evidence both from what others said of him and from what he himself actually did. Jesus Christ himself used and sanctioned the use of wine. Well, how are we going to explain that then? Well, in the context of him saying that he had been accused of being a wine bibber and a gluttonous man, in the context of that, in the verses just before that, he points out that he was dealing with people who really would never be satisfied. They were his critics. They were fault finders. They would never be satisfied with anything that he did or taught. He said in verses 16 and 17, whereunto shall I liken this generation? It is likened to children sitting in the markets and calling to their fellows and saying, we have piped unto you and ye have not danced. We have mourned unto you and ye have not lamented. In other words, you wouldn't be happy if we hung you with a new rope. You know, they're just not going to be satisfied, no matter what was done. And then immediately on the heels of saying that, he made that statement. John neither ate or drank. He said he had a devil. I come eating and drinking, and you say a gluttonous man and a wine bibber. So understand the context. He's dealing with fault-finding critics, okay? They are the ones who said about him that he was a gluttonous man and a wine bibber. Now, think first about what they said about John. They said John has a devil. Well, that wasn't true, right? That was an absolute lie. In fact, Jesus said there's none greater born among women than John the Baptist. So what they said about John the Baptist was just an absolute lie. Why then would we think that their accusations against Jesus were just or had any basis in fact? Why would we, contextually understand what's taking place here. He's dealing with the criticism of his fault-finding enemies. Notice, unlike John, Jesus associated with the public, even those despised by the Jewish hierarchy. They charged him with being a gluttonous man and a wine bibber. Here's some things to consider. Certainly these critics were hypercritical, hypocritical. They were not going to be pleased with him no matter what. But please notice that they were not accusing him of moderate social drinking. That's not what they were accusing him of. They were accusing him of being a drunk. The word wine bibber literally means a tippler, a drunk. And so those who want to say, well, they're talking about Jesus' practice here. And Jesus' practice, therefore, would justify us engaging in moderate social drinking. Well, that's not even what's in the context. What's in the context is they accused him of being a drunk, right? Understand that for sure. Then notice that there is a contrast being drawn here between John and Jesus. And the contrast is a legitimate one. John, most people agree that John lived as a Nazarite, although it's not expressly said so in Luke chapter 1, verse 15. But as such, he would not consume anything produced from the grapevine. Right? We understand that was the rule of the Nazarite, number 6, verses 3 and 4. Jesus acknowledged that his conduct was different from that he came eating and drinking. And so this would certainly demonstrate that he ate some, that he drank some product of the grapevine, but it would not prove conclusively that he drank intoxicating wine, right? There was a contrast. John didn't touch anything that came from the grapevine. Jesus did, but that would not follow that it was intoxicating wine, right? You couldn't prove that. Jesus didn't simply acknowledge that he drank some. His critics accused him of being a friend of publicans and sinners. Well, he was, of course. But did that indicate that he participated in their sins? Obviously not. The charge, be careful here what you want to prove from this text. Prove a little, you may prove too much. If we accept the accusation that he was a wine bibber, does that also mean that he was a glutton? If one's true, then the other's true. Really, Jesus ate some, but he wasn't a glutton, right? He drank something that came from the grapevine. He didn't deny that. But that doesn't prove he was drinking intoxicating wine. Just be careful how we're using that text and know who the charge came from, his critics. His enemies accused him of having a devil, just like they did John. Obviously false. One author said the critics of Jesus here were unscrupulous, malignant, not noted for their truthfulness. I agree, don't you? And so I think we'd be on shaky ground to go to that statement about Jesus and try to use it as proof that he participated in intoxicating wine. All right, one more from the life, the personal practice and example of Jesus. And I'm actually amazed that people would go to this argument to try and justify social drinking. But I've studied with a young preacher who made this argument. Jesus drank wine. He drank it when he was on the cross of Calvary. We know that Jesus was offered wine two times, or offered something from the grape two times on the cross. First, he was offered wine mixed with some drugs that was intended to dull the pain. We talked about this a little last night. Matthew 27:34, the King James says they gave him vinegar to drink mingled with gall, and when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink. The King James has wine there, but both the Nestle Greek text and the Westcott and Hort text use the word oinos, wine, there. So I think this should be wine, not vinegar. Note that. You might make a marginal note in your King James Version, but that's probably not the right way to translate that. That should be wine, not vinegar. We'll talk about vinegar in a minute. Mark has that they gave him wine mingled with myrrh, but he received it not. But then later, Matthew 27, straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed, gave him some to drink. Both Mark and John talk about the vinegar. All right. So what do we got going on here? Jeff Coates says that oxos, not oinos, but oxos, is formed when vinous fermentation is not well regulated wine is converted to vinegar. A man named Hovey says concerning that vinegar that it was neither exhilarating nor intoxicating. All right. Adam Clark says wine mixed with myrrh was given to malefactors at the place of crucifixion to intoxicate them, make them less sensible to pain. Christ therefore refused. But if vinegar was offered to him, which was taken merely to assuage thirst, then there would be no reason for him to reject it. Jeff Coates says, even if it could be proved that oxos, vinegar, was intoxicating, it would prove nothing about the Savior's principles of abstinence. It was taken under circumstances so utterly exceptional, the only possible analogy with which our own case would be medicinal consideration, that no inference can be drawn from it concerning the present subject. I think that's the fair point. I mean, you want to quibble whether the vinegar could intoxicate you or not? Well, even if it did. I don't think it did, probably. But if it did, this case would be an example of medicinal use wine. I don't think any of us here have a problem with using alcohol or narcotic drugs if it's for a legitimate medicinal purpose. This case, I mean, I think is a real stretch. Actually, I believe that if you got to go to that to try and prove your practice of social drinking, if it demonstrates anything at all, it demonstrates what a weak position you're trying to defend, likely. Okay, so from Jesus' personal practice and example, I don't think we can conclude at all that he supported the use of alcoholic wine. What about his teaching? So let's eliminate his example. Jesus didn't participate. What about what he taught? Again, let's start with what I think is probably the most frequently used argument, and that is that statement about new wine in old bottles. Matthew 9, Mark 2, Luke chapter 5 all mention effectively the same thing. Notice Luke 5, 37, no man putteth new wine in old bottles, else the new wine will burst the bottles and be spilled, and the bottles shall perish. Now understand how this is being used. This goes directly to the things Kyle was teaching us yesterday. The argument is being made that you put new wine, unfermented grape juice, in new skins so that the skins will be able to expand and stretch with the pressure produced by fermentation, right? Now, you don't put that in old skins because presumably the old skins would have already stretched to their limit. You put more wine in, the new wine in there, and it begins to ferment. Now those skins can't stretch, and they'll burst. Now that's the argument that's made. This whole thing is really an argument, a false argument. Kyle proved this to us emphatically yesterday. But this is a false argument saying they had no way to preserve unfermented grape juice back in those days. And they're trying to use this statement of Jesus to prove that. Well, the fact of the matter is, again, all this, just sort of reiterating what Kyle taught us so well last night, the fact is that neither new nor old wineskins could withstand the pressure formed from fermentation. One source said a cubic inch of sugar transformed into carbonic gas, the gas produced during fermentation, takes up to 40 times more volume. And Kyle mentioned there's references to wine bursting wooden barrels that are sealed up from the pressures of fermentation. You can't contain it in a new or an old wineskin. A reference from Elihu in the book of Job, as he was confronting Job and the other men who were present, he said, "Behold, my belly is as wine which hath no vent. It is ready to burst like new bottles." New bottles will burst under the pressure of fermentation if they are sealed up. Actually, new wine was put into new bottles to prevent it from fermenting. Old wineskins would have the remnants of previous fermentation in it. You put new wine in there, it's going to begin the fermentation process. If you seal it, if you put new wine in an old wineskin that has been open to the air and therefore has remnants of fermentation in it, it's going to commence fermentation. You can't hold it. You plug it up, you cap it, you seal it, it's going to burst because of the gas pressure produced in fermentation. One source said, when it was desired to preserve a quantity in the sweet state, an amphora was taken, coated with pitch within and without. It was filled and corked so as to be perfectly airtight. And so that's why you use a new wineskin. You use a new wineskin to be able to preserve unfermented grape juice. We know a lot about that now based upon what Kyle taught us. I think his experiment is so encouraging to know about. He's not just talking about something he read, he's talking about something he did. And he's proved to us that you certainly can preserve unfermented grape juice. But that's the reason that argument is made, new wine in old bottles. Now, in that same context, Jesus said something about the old wine is better. If we go back to Luke chapter 5, he said, "No man having drunk old wine straightway desireth new, for he saith, the old is better." You ever thought about that? Some people say Jesus approved alcoholic wine because he acknowledged old wine is better than new wine. How are we going to deal with that? This Kenneth Gentry, the Presbyterian author I referenced earlier, said that this speaks of the well-nigh universal preference of men to prefer old fermented wine over new, pre- or unfermented wine. The Lord himself makes reference to this assessment. Another author, Tilson, said, without a word of criticism, as if expressing a truism with which he himself agrees, Luke records Jesus as saying, "And no one after drinking old wine desires new." Why? "The old is good," he answers, "though far more likely to be both fermented and intoxicating." So you see how they're using that. They're using this statement of Jesus, "The old is better," to be an acknowledgement of Jesus that old fermented wine is to be preferred. Okay, notice though, when Jesus said that, he wasn't talking about his own judgment or his own view. He's talking about the view of those who have the habit of drinking intoxicating wine. Having drunk old wine, he says, Jesus said, he didn't ascribe this view to himself. He said, the guy who drinks it, the guy who's in the habit of drinking old wine, he likes it. Several quotes here. I'm going to have to hurry for time. I'm going to skip some of them. Linsky says, it is not Jesus who calls the old wine good enough, but he that drank it. Jack Van Impe, I don't think I've ever quoted Jack Van Impe positively, but I think he has an interesting observation here. He says, this shows the Lord's understanding of the habit-forming effect of beverage alcohol. His statement stands true today. Try to sell grape juice on Skid Row and you will probably have no takers. They are hooked, he says. And his point is right. The idea is that drunks, this statement of Jesus, the old wine is better, in the view of those who participate in old wine. That's what Jesus said. Those who participate in drinking old wine, those who drink intoxicating wine, say it's better. He wasn't saying that he has that view. He was saying they have that view. All right? Now, why would Jesus make that reference? Well, in the context of that statement, Jesus is contrasting his new instruction with the old teaching and practice of the Pharisees. Check it out. That's the context of this statement by Jesus. Jesus was actually showing the superiority of his teaching and showing that the two systems, what he was teaching and what the Pharisees were teaching and practicing, those are incompatible with one another. He was saying, what I'm teaching is superior, and what I'm teaching is not compatible with what you're hearing from the Pharisees. He used three illustrations to prove that point. He talked about you don't put new cloth, use a new cloth to patch an old garment. They're not compatible. He said, new wine is not put into old wineskins. We just talked about that. That causes ruin. In other words, you can't combine these two systems. That's what Jesus is saying. They're not compatible with one another. And he's saying, actually, what I'm teaching you is a superior way. And then he made that statement that new wine is not liked by those who are in the custom of drinking old wine. The old, he says, seems good because one is not accustomed to the new. And the new is actually better. But he says, those who drink old wine, they're going to keep wanting to get drunk on the old wine. Now, I think the key to explaining this passage is this. To argue that Jesus was acknowledging the superiority of the old wine over the new would really destroy the whole meaning of the context. It would actually have Jesus saying, the old way of the Pharisees is better than the new way I'm teaching you. And that's exactly opposite of the point that Jesus was trying to make. Do you see that? And so those who would use this statement by Jesus, the old is better, and ascribe that to him, he didn't acknowledge that that was his position. He said, that's the position of the fellow who drinks intoxicating wine. He didn't say, that's my position. And to argue that Jesus himself was acknowledging that the old is better than the new would have Jesus arguing that the old way that the Pharisees teach is better than my way that I'm teaching. It would destroy the whole purpose of his discussion there. That's a false argument. And so again, the old wine is better argument fails. Wine and wounds. Again, I am shocked that some people would go to this extreme in sort of grasping for straws to justify social drinking. They go to the parable of the Good Samaritan. You remember in Luke chapter 10, verse 33, a certain Samaritan went to the man who had been beaten, bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, set him on his own beast, brought him to an inn, took care of him. We're going to use this to justify social drinking. It's incredible to me, but some do. First of all, this was clearly an external medicinal application of wine. It couldn't even prove that it was intoxicating wine, right? This may have just been grape juice. You couldn't infer anything from the text as to the intoxicating ability of the wine that the Good Samaritan used in his parable, right? It's a parable. Patton, in his book, says this was an external medicinal application. The mixture of the two, oil and wine, formed a healing ointment. Pliny mentions oleum glucinum, which was compounded of oil and glucose, sweet wine. It was an excellent ointment for wounds. Columella, that's the fellow that Kyle talked about, the Roman official from first century Syria. He actually gives a receipt or a recipe for making it. But again, if that's what I'm reduced to, if that's the best I can come up with to justify drinking, is the parable of the Good Samaritan, I'm in bad shape. I need to abandon my position if that's all I've got to support my conclusion. The old idea. So really, what we're saying, in both the personal practice and example of Jesus and in his teaching, I just can't find any support for those who would say Jesus endorsed the use of intoxicating wine. How much time we got, Jim? Okay. Jim suggested maybe we deal with one more thing in this lecture, and that is the question of, did Jesus use intoxicating wine or alcoholic wine when he instituted the Lord's Supper? And if he did, then should we be using alcoholic wine in our practice of observing the Lord's Supper today? I want to try to deal with that by just asking some questions and leaving it to you to decide, to us all to decide. What do you think? First of all, does the fact that Jesus called it fruit of the vine rather than wine, does that indicate that it was non-alcoholic grape juice? You know the text. We won't take time to read them. Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22. They all speak of the fruit of the vine. Now, as McGuigan says, he finds that expression only six other times, all in the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. He says there that it's always a reference to the solid fruit, not the juice. And so he concludes, I think it's probably the right conclusion, that nothing conclusive can be determined by the use of the expression fruit of the vine. I think that's probably the safe ground to take. But I would just ask you this question. With the word wine, oinos, so commonly used, isn't it somewhat curious that Jesus didn't use that in regards to the Lord's Supper? He specifically used the expression fruit of the vine. Did he intend to emphasize unfermented grape juice? I'll just leave that to you, but I think it's interesting. Why would there be a different, apparently intentional, different use of terminology here in regards to the Lord's Supper? Think about that. Secondly, does the fact that the Jews were to rid their houses of leaven during the Passover indicate that unfermented wine was used? I've heard this argument forever. Is it a sound argument? I think our brethren have used this a lot through the years. Well, I think the key command in the law is Exodus 12, beginning verse 15. 7 days shall ye eat unleavened bread, even the first day ye shall put away leaven out of your houses. For whosoever eateth leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. 7 days shall there be no leaven found in your houses. The leaven here of Exodus 12, 15, Seor, includes anything that can produce fermentation, applicable to any matter capable of producing fermentation, one expert says. A professor, Moses Stewart, says the Hebrew kamatz, translated leavened bread, means anything fermented, all leaven. Anything fermented was excluded. Bakayoki says references to fermented wine in the celebration of the Passover are not found in the Mishnah. You remember that the Mishnah was the earliest recording of the Jewish oral traditions. He says references to fermented wine not found in the Mishnah. But he says in later annotations of the Talmud, in other words, later commentaries on the Talmud, in there, references to the intoxicating nature of Passover wine have been extracted. So he says, you can find some references to them using intoxicating wine in the observance of the Passover, but that's in later references. The earlier references do not have that. What are we going to say then? Well, again, I think there's not total agreement here, but probably some significant evidence in support of the conclusion that what Jesus would have used was non-alcoholic wine when he instituted the Lord's Supper. Think about that. See what you think. What about the time of the year? Does the time of the year that the Passover was celebrated, does that prove that it had to be fermented wine? Because the wines would have been harvested in the fall. The Passover was observed in the spring. How are we going to have fresh grape juice in the spring if the grapes have been harvested for 6 months or so when the Passover comes around? That's the argument, right? And that argument is based upon the misunderstanding that the Jews didn't know how to preserve unfermented grape juice. We know better, right? I thought this was an interesting quote off of an internet blog site. This fellow says, if Jesus did in fact use fresh grape juice at the Last Supper, then the only means available almost 2,000 years ago was by crushing some grapes and no more than a few hours before drinking it. The time of the Passover will always fall in the end of March or the beginning of April, the time between the bunches of grapes being taken off the vine late September and Jesus needing some to crush for fresh grape juice late March is about 6 months apart. How do you keep bunches of grapes fresh enough to crush for juice for 6 months without refrigeration? The simple answer is you can't. With no fresh grapes available to turn into juice, it is obvious that Jesus is pointing us to wine as the fruit of the vine. I hope you would agree with me, and certainly based upon what Kyle taught, that's an embarrassingly uninformed statement, wouldn't you agree? In other words, to try and argue it had to be fermented wine because there would have been no way to keep unfermented juice or fresh grapes for that long. That fellow just hasn't done his homework at all, has he? Certainly no support for alcoholic wine in the observance of the Lord's Supper from that argument. What about what we can know of the practice of the Jews during the Passover time? Obviously, the Lord's Supper was instituted among faithful Jews, Jesus and his apostles, during the time of the observance of the Passover. What can we know about that? Would it argue for fermented or unfermented grape juice? Well, I think there's mixed references here too. The Jewish Encyclopedia says the wafer and the wine of the communion service then instituted by him as a memorial would be the unleavened bread and the unfermented wine of the Seder Passover. The Cyclopedia of Biblical Literature says the wine used would of course be unfermented. The Mishnah, again, the earliest recording of the Jewish oral traditions, the Mishnah states that Jews were in the habit of using boiled wine. We know boiled wine would be unfermented, right? So these sources suggest the practice of Jews way back, anciently, would have been to use unfermented wine. Then some references to modern practice. a man named Allen, a 19th century author, said, "The Jews are forbidden to drink any liquor made from grain or that has passed through the process of fermentation. Their drink is either pure water or raisin wine prepared by themselves." Raisin wine, you understand, would be raisins rehydrated and used to make wine, which would have been unfermented. And then Patton says, "The Jews do not, in their feast for sacred purposes, ever use any kind of fermented drinks. In their oblations and libations, both private and public, they employ the fruit of the vine, that is, fresh grapes, unfermented grape juice, and raisins." Now, that's talking about current practice. Now, I don't think that there's complete unanimous agreement on that. Not all agree about that. I think you can find opposing references. But again, I would argue from what you're able to read on that question that the Jewish practice of the Passover would probably push you in the direction of saying Jesus was using unfermented wine in that observance. Finally, one last question. I'm going to observe the Passover on this question because I'm going to throw this to Brett. Brett's going to nail this down. The question of 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 21. You remember there that Paul was condemning the Corinthians about their abuses of the Lord's Supper. He said, "When you come together, therefore, into one place, this is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in eating, everyone taketh before other his own supper. One is hungry, another is drunken." That statement by some says, well, that proves, of course, that it had to have been intoxicating wine. This Kenneth Gentry said, "How could the Corinthians get drunk on communion wine if it were not fermented?" You see the argument that's being made there? I'm going to stop right there and let Brett answer the rest of that. But I'm firmly convinced that that's not going to prove anything about the fruit of the vine being alcoholic in the observance of the Lord's Supper. Thanks for your good attention.
Got about